looked away. I stood and walked to the door, but turned back when I remembered something. "Thank you for the poetry." He looked at me again, but said nothing in return. Lady Caroline was ready to plan the ball when I met her in the drawing room. Mrs. Clampett and Rachel were engaged in the sorts of activities that elegant ladies do, sewing and music and reading. They were clearly resigned to their roles as elegant ladies. I should resign myself to mine as well. But after sitting with Lady Caroline for an hour and a half, discussing every aspect of the ball, I ached with restlessness. She looked up from her lists and saw me shifting in my seat.
"I think this is enough for now. Thank you for your help."
I stood and looked around the room. What to do now? Mrs. Clampett sat practicing the pianoforte, reminding me that I should try to be accomplished. I sat next to Rachel on the settee and picked up the embroidery I found there, but my mind was not on my work. Something was bothering me, but it was just beyond the edge of my awareness, and I couldn't pull it to the surface. After several minutes, it came to me. It was the trip that William and Philip had mentioned, and which I had heard nothing about. Had it been my imagination, or were they all keeping it a secret from me? Rachel glanced at me. "Good heavens, what are you doing to my embroidery?" I looked down and realized that it was not mine, and that I had just embroidered random stitches all over the cloth. I dropped it abruptly. "Pardon me." Rachel picked up the embroidery and began to pick out threads. The pianoforte was loud, assuring me that the others would not overhear. "William seems to be looking forward to this trip," I said nonchalantly. Rachel frowned at the tangle of a French knot that I had made, trying to pick it apart with a needle. "Yes," she sighed, "I have resigned myself to it, because they enjoy it so, but my father would never have approved of it." She gave me a look of long suffering. "He was a rector. Thank goodness he is in his grave." I stared at her as she pulled out the stitches I had so clumsily made. What were Philip and William going to do that a rector would disapprove of? Rachel went on, "But such are the ways of men. I know I couldn't stop William if I tried, so I don't. I have decided that the less I know about what they do, the better I feel about it. Sometimes ignorance is the best defense, you know?" I was stunned. I tried to think of some other explanation, but all I could think was that the only reason a woman would not want to know what her husband was doing was if he was doing something improper. Although I had never been to town, I knew enough that I could fit the pieces of the puzzle together for myself. After all, I had heard rumors about Mr. Kellett's scandals enough times that I understood the gist of what he was doing. Betsy had told me plenty, too, about what people in London did. But I could hardly believe they could talk about such things so casually. Why, they had spoken about their trip in front of Lady Caroline. I suddenly saw the Wyndham family in a new light, and I was horribly disappointed in the whole lot of them. But I couldn't say anything or react in the way I wanted to. It would only bring further embarrassment upon me, just as it had with Cecily and Louisa. Of course, I didn't know William well at all. But Philip, I had thought he was such a gentleman. He seemed so noble. I had thought he would somehow be above such things. How could I have been so mistaken in my understanding of his character? I felt ill and knew that I must escape at once. I said something about needing to get something from my room and fled as quickly as possible. But I did not go to my room, for I knew there was no peace to be found there. Instead, I roamed the house in a distracted state, trying not to imagine Philip doing things a rector wouldn't approve of, until my face was hot and my heart was sick. In my distracted wanderings, I ended up on the third floor and stopped in front of the paintings there. Perhaps if I had something beautiful to occupy my mind, I would be able to push aside the sick feeling that roiled within me. I had examined only a few of the landscapes, however, when I realized I was hearing an odd noise. It sounded like the clang of metal on metal, and it gradually pulled me from my concentration until curiosity drove me to explore the source. I followed the sound until I came to the room I had seen once before on my tour of the house. The fencing room. The door was slightly ajar, and I could look in without being seen. The sight that greeted me caused my heart to leap into my throat. It was Philip in his breeches and shirt, fencing with William. Philip looked lithe and strong and graceful and powerful. My throat went dry, and I stood still, afraid to make a noise, unable to tear my eyes away. He drove William hard against the wall, but William held him off, foil against foil.
"Rein it in, Philip. I'd rather not be injured."
Philip stepped back and muttered, "Sorry." As he turned, I saw his face clearly for the first time and caught my breath. I had never imagined he could look so impassioned. He looked as if he had a fire burning within him, and that, if he ever unleashed it, it would consume everyone around him.
"I assume this mood has something to do with your assignment," William said, seeming to put stress on the last word.
He looked amused.
"You know it does," Philip said curtly. "Is it really that bad?"
William was definitely amused. Philip raked a hand through his hair.
"Worse than ever. I don't know how much longer I can tolerate it."
William chuckled, and Philip scowled at him.
"You find this humorous, I see. After all the women you've run away from, yes, I do find this humorous."
Philip did not smile in return, though. I suddenly wondered if it was appropriate for me to be listening to their conversation. How embarrassing if they were to catch me listening outside the door. I was about to back up and try to escape undetected when William spoke.
"Her grandmother arranged the visit, didn't she? Why can't you just send her back to Bath?"
I froze at his words. They were talking about me.
"I would if it were possible," Philip said. "Anything would be better than having her here. But it's out of the question. Her grandmother was very clear on that point. She doesn't want her in Bath."
He sighed. "I want nothing more than to be rid of my responsibility toward her. And yet, she has nowhere else to go." My heart pounded so hard it hurt.
"We're leaving tomorrow," William said. "Perhaps her father will come back while we're gone and take her home. Then all of this will be resolved easily." "I wish you were right, but I doubt it."
Philip tapped his boot with his sword.
"He has stayed away for more than a year now, and is unlikely to return any time soon." "Then it looks like you will have to suffer it out," William grinned and lifted his foil. "Just try not to take out your frustration on me."
Philip muttered something that I couldn't hear, giving William a dark look. William just laughed. As they began to fence again, I stepped back and turned numbly from the door. I walked slowly, very slowly, down the hall, around the corner, down the stairs, and to my bedchamber. I closed the door and crossed the room to look out the window, fighting to keep from my heart the truth that had been thrust upon me. I may as well have been trying to blot out the sun. There was no escape from being unwanted, and that was the truth that struck at me the most deeply. Nobody wanted me, not my father or my grandmother or the Wyndhams, not Louisa, maybe not even Cecily, and certainly not Philip. I had grown accustomed to my father's abandonment, and I had suspected that my grandmother had not welcomed being responsible for me. But I had never doubted Philip's friendship, not since that day we had spent together in the library. I had felt so sure of it, convinced that not even his horrid flirting could diminish the strength of the bond I felt between us. Now, to discover that I had been wrong about everything, about Philip's character as well as his regard for me, was a blow so great that I reeled from it. Philip was not a gentleman, and he was not my friend. It was all an elaborate pretense. There was nothing real and nothing true for me to stand on. I felt like I did the first time I had been thrown from a horse, with the reins yanked from my hands and the ground rushing up at me. Then, as now, there was nothing I could do to prevent the pain that was coming. Chapter 19. I lay on my bed and stared at nothing. I tried to think of nothing as well, and wished that nothing could be all that was within and around me. Betsy interrupted my exercise in nothingness, the ultimate avoidance, by standing beside my bed, hands on hips. "Aren't you going to the ball tonight?" "No." I closed my eyes and tried to resume my state of nothingness. But even with my eyes closed, I could feel her looking at me. Then she said, "You look just like my father did when his favorite dog died." I opened my eyes at that. "Excuse me?" "It's true. He had that same look about him, as if nothing else in the world could make up for what he had lost." She sighed as she sat down on the bed. "And nothing ever did." I groaned. "Thank you, Betsy. That is very comforting." I turned away from her, hoping she would leave me to my misery, but she reached out and touched my shoulder gently. "Do you want to tell me what happened?" I considered lying to her. I considered remaining silent. But the knowledge I had acquired today filled me to the brim, begging for an outlet. I had never confided in Betsy before, but she might be the closest thing to a friend I had here, and she might know something that would help me understand why I had been so fooled. I found out that my grandmother arranged for this visit. I wasn't invited at all. My voice caught on the words. I could not tell her the rest. I could not tell anyone the most shameful part of it. I wasn't wanted here, either. "Oh, is that all?" she said breezily. "I could have told you that weeks ago." I sat up. "What? What do you mean?" She picked something out of her teeth. "Well, I knew all along that your grandmother arranged this, but she threatened to cut out my tongue and eat it for breakfast if I did so much as breathe a word of it to you. And I don't know what I would do without a tongue." I rolled my eyes. "Betsy, I am sure she would not have eaten it for breakfast," I muttered. "You know she only eats meat at dinner." Betsy frowned. "I hadn't thought of that." "Well, yes, she did send you here. Only she didn't want you to know, so she arranged it with Lady Caroline. I'm not sure what part Lady Cecily played in it all, but my guess is Lady Caroline asked her to extend the invitation so you wouldn't be suspicious. And truthfully, I think it was a famous plan, for Sir Philip would never have looked at you twice if you had met in London. And this has worked out very much to your advantage, if I may say so." "To my advantage? Why do you think that?" I couldn't find anything advantageous about being thrust upon an unwilling host. "Why, so that you could ensnare him, of course." My mouth fell open. "Ensnare Sir Philip?" She swung her leg back and forth. "Yes, what other purpose could there be for this visit? And what luck that we happened to stop at that inn so that he was forced to come back." I could not keep myself from asking. "What do you mean? He was forced to come back?" "Well, you know, he was running away when we met up with him at the inn. Running away from you, I mean. Can you imagine a grown man willing to spend months away from home just so he wouldn't have to meet you? But look how fate managed everything, what with James getting shot and Sir Philip stopping for a bite to eat before continuing on his journey." She looked at me, her expression turning sharp. "You must have known that." I shook my head. "I did not." "But what did you imagine he was doing at the inn that late at night?" "I didn't even think about it." "Well, from what I heard, as soon as he got word that you were coming, he flew out of here as if the devil himself were chasing him." "As if the devil himself were chasing him." I recalled my conversation with Miss Grace, how she had assumed I was just another ambitious female with my cap set on Philip. Betsy, does everyone think I came here to ensnare Sir Philip?
She shrugged. I imagine so. That's the talk in the kitchen, at least.
I hope you set them straight.
She bit her lip and looked away.
Betsy! Well, it would have been difficult to make anyone believe otherwise, considering how you've been carrying on.
I choked.
Carrying on? How have I been carrying on?
You know, spending so much time with him, and the way you look at him.
How do I look at him?
I asked, as dread filled me. She waved a hand in the air.
As if he created happiness.
I groaned and lay back on the bed, covering my face with my hands. I felt consumed by embarrassment. All of those hours I had spent with Philip in what I deemed to be innocent companionship had been noted and gossiped about by all the servants. They seemed like tainted hours now, and I regretted every one of them.
What will you do about the ball? Betsy asked.
Will you give me a little time, alone?
Of course.
She left the room quietly. I stood and paced in front of the window. I had to leave. I couldn't stay where I wasn't wanted. But where could I go? My grandmother had sent me here, and it seemed she didn't want me to return to Bath. My father hadn't answered my last three letters, and I had no other close relatives that I could impose on. In desperation, I sat at my writing desk and took out a piece of paper. My father might not want me any longer, but I had a right to call on him for help. I scrawled a message to him, worried that if I thought too much about my words, I would cry and ruin the letter. Dear Papa, I am sorry that my horse balked at the jump that morning. I am sorry that Mama's horse threw a shoe, and so she took mine instead. I have thought and thought and thought if I might have prevented the accident. But I cannot think how, and it is too late to undo it. What I must know is if you blame me, and if you still love me, and why you have abandoned me when I have needed you so much. Love, Marianne. I quickly folded the letter, biting my lip to keep myself from losing control of my emotions. If I started to cry now, I didn't know how I would ever be able to stop. I opened the drawer of the writing desk to retrieve the wax and seal, but my fingers froze as I spied the two letters tucked in the back of the drawer, Philip's love letter and his note. I pulled them out, carefully unfolded them, and read each one. My heart ached and then throbbed with anger and resentment. How dare he deceive me? How dare he pretend to be my friend when all along he wanted to be rid of me? I knew what I had to do. I tore the love letter in half, then half again, then half again. I could still see some of the words, though. Torment. Adore. Desperately. Each word stabbed me with the pain of betrayal. I ripped the words again and again, wishing I could obliterate every feeling in my heart as easily. I didn't stop until there was nothing left but tiny, unreadable crumbs of paper. Then I did the same thing with his note, swept the pile of broken words into my hands, and threw them all into the fireplace. When Betsy came back a few minutes later, I handed her the letter addressed to my father. Will you see that this gets mailed as soon as possible? She nodded and tucked the letter into her pocket.
But what about the ball?
The ball. Philip would be at the ball. But so would Mr. Beaufort. Mr. Beaufort was interested in me. He might even want to marry me. I checked my heart again and felt nothing from it. It was dull and empty, lifeless. That was exactly the way I wanted it.
Yes, I am going, but I want to look more beautiful tonight than I ever have before. Are you up to the challenge?
She clapped her hands.
Leave it to me. You will look ravishing, I am sure.
I smiled grimly.
When I stood before the mirror after Betsy had finished with me, I studied myself with an objective eye. I wore the green silk gown, and I did not look like a very young girl anymore. Perhaps it was the hairstyle and the jewelry and the gown, but I thought it had just as much to do with the glint in my eye. Betsy stood back to look at me, critically, from head to toe. She finally nodded with approval. "You won't even need to pinch your cheeks tonight," she said. "They are already rosy." I thanked her and pulled on my long gloves as I left the room and walked down the hall. I paused before I reached the stairs. Hiding in the shadows, I breathed deeply and tried to prepare myself mentally for what was coming. My only hope for success tonight was pinned on my being able to remain immune to Philip's charm. I had to keep my heart shut away and silent. If he disassembled my defenses, it was possible I might lose the dignity I was working so hard for. And then I might do something unpardonable, like cry in his presence, or tell him that I knew he didn't want me here. Therefore, I built up my armor, chink by chink, against him. I repeated to myself all that I held against Philip. I thought of his many faults as I walked with careful dignity down the stairs. He lied, for one. He told me I was welcome here when I was not. He led me into a false sense of security by making me feel certain he was my friend, when all along he wanted to be rid of me. He was arrogant, for another. If he thought I would come all this way in the hope of ensnaring a man I had never met, what an assumption! Did he think every woman who glanced his way was pining for him, would sacrifice her dignity for the chance of securing him as her husband? Well, he was much mistaken, for I would never sacrifice anything for him. The butler opened the doors to the drawing room, and I stepped inside. The rest of the family was already assembled, but I hardly noticed them. I only noticed Philip as he quickly looked my way, and I saw something flash in his eyes that looked like admiration. But I must have been mistaken, for he did not admire me. He wanted to be rid of me. I remembered my task at hand and moved to the other side of the room, where I could continue to list his faults to myself without having to be near him. He was too handsome, much too handsome. Especially tonight, in his formal black, with his waistcoat and cravat snowy white, and his hair gleaming in the candlelight, and his eyes meeting mine across the room with a question in them. I turned away so I would not have to see his much too handsome face. It was a great fault of his, for it led feeling young ladies to want to forgive his other faults for the sake of his eyes and his smile. He was persistent. I added that to my list of his faults when he crossed the room to me, even though I obviously wanted nothing to do with him. "What have I done to deserve that look?" he asked in a low voice so that nobody else could hear. It was a deceptive thing to do, for it made it seem like we were co-conspirators instead of an unwilling host and an unwanted guest. "You have done nothing, sir."
"Sir?"
He said it as if it was an insult.
"Now I know it's serious. Tell me at once so that I may apologize."
I laughed lightly, but I felt nothing but hardness inside. "You're imagining things." Philip frowned as the butler opened the door and announced that the carriage was ready. As I turned to the door, I saw Cecily watching me with a suspicious look. It didn't bother me, though. She could have Sir Philip Wyndham. They would make a perfect pair, the two of them. She would flirt with Mr. Kellett while Philip went away to do things a rector wouldn't approve of, and they could live a happy, deceitful, immoral life together. I made sure I did not sit next to Philip in the carriage, but the way it turned out was worse, for Philip sat directly across from me, with his knee brushing mine when the carriage swayed around a turn, and his gaze fixed on me so completely that I felt my face burning. To distract myself, I continued my list. He was too perceptive. I did not like that about him at all, He always said I had an expressive face, but the fault was his for seeing too much. I did not want him to know anything of my heart tonight, so I kept my face averted, choosing to look out the window and paying no heed to the conversation of the others. I nearly had my list and my armor complete when we stopped in front of the assembly hall. Philip stepped out of the carriage first, then turned to me and offered me his hand, which I was forced to accept, or else risk tripping and falling to the ground. His grip was strong and dependable and familiar. My defenses trembled at his touch. "Too handsome," I repeated to myself, "too perceptive, too charming." I had added that last one to the list during the carriage ride. "Too familiar, too moving, too persistent." Of course, I could not forget the most important, "too deceitful." I dropped his hand as soon as I touched the ground and felt both relieved and disappointed at the same time. I must work harder at schooling my heart, I told myself. I must not let it override the rational workings of my mind. I saw Mr. Beaufort as soon as I entered the ballroom. He began to make his way across the crowded room toward me. Philip stood at my side, and even though I intentionally did not look at him, his closeness was making me very nervous. I tried to find my smile and my poise as Mr. Beaufort drew near, but I could hardly breathe with Philip standing so close. Then I saw Mr. Kellett smirking at me from across the room, which made the evening even worse.
"Will you dance with me tonight?"
Philip asked in a quiet voice. My heart skipped at least 3 beats. I pulled up my gloves, feigning interest in them. "No, thank you," I said, striving for nonchalance in my voice. Mr. Beaufort was only a few steps away when a group of women moved between us, blocking his path.
"No, thank you?"
Philip asked, disbelief in his voice. My heart was pounding, my face flushed. I dared a quick glance up at Philip. He was searching my face as if for clues, his brow contracted, his mouth a tight line.
"What has happened?"
I shrugged and looked away from him. "Absolutely nothing." Philip was clearly upset. The thought gave me a mean sort of pleasure. He should be upset. He was, after all, the cause of everything that was wrong about this evening. He was the deceiver, not I. I ignored the quiet voice inside of me that reminded me of the lies I had told tonight. Mr. Beaufort had maneuvered around the group of women and was now but a few paces away from me. Philip stood so close that I could feel his warmth even though we were not touching. I gripped my hands together. He was too close. His warmth, his intensity, and his familiarity were all working against my defenses. But before I could step away from him, he leaned down and spoke low in my ear, so low that nobody else could have heard.
"You look beautiful tonight."
A shiver spread through me, and I blushed furiously, for Philip's quiet voice had made the words sound sincere. In the next instant, he straightened and walked away without looking back. I tore my gaze away from Philip's broad shoulders to see Mr. Beaufort standing before me and bowing.
"Miss Daventry, you have grown in beauty in just the few days since we met."
I tried to feel flattered, but his words fell on my ears with a hollow ring. Nevertheless, I smiled and murmured, "Thank you." A dance was beginning. I gave Mr. Beaufort my hand and allowed him to lead me to the dance floor, where couples were lining up across from each other. I focused my gaze on him and tried to forget the warring emotions of the day. I tried to quiet my heart, which had been bounding at a furious pace ever since I had seen Philip tonight. Taking a deep breath, I told myself to focus on the task at hand. Tonight was an exercise in learning how to be an elegant lady. I would do everything I could to forget that Philip was even in the room. It would be easy to do, especially since I had already refused to dance with him. I smiled brightly at Mr. Beaufort, ready to try my hand at flirting, until seconds before the dance started. That was when I noticed Philip standing on Mr. Beaufort's right hand. I looked at him with surprise, then to my left, and saw that Cecily was his partner. Her smile had that tinge of suggestiveness that made me think of what she learned in London about kissing rakes. A surge of jealousy rose so swiftly within my breast that I lost my breath for a moment. I turned my gaze back to Mr. Beaufort, but I had to work very hard to remember that I didn't care what Philip or Cecily did. The music began. It was a lively dance, which was fortunate because it left little opportunity for speaking. I tried to smile at Mr. Beaufort and not look at Philip, but it took so much effort that by the end of the dance I was exhausted. I hardly had time to catch my breath before another gentleman stepped forward and asked me to dance. This time Cecily danced with Mr. Kellett. I saw Philip down the line dancing with Miss Grace, even though I was not looking for him. I thought I should practice my flirting to keep my mind off of Philip, but I was hardly successful. My smile was forced, and my attention kept wandering to Philip and the words I had heard him speak to William. After a few more dances, the musicians took a break. I stood by an open window and allowed my gaze to sweep the crowd. Without effort, my eyes caught on Philip. I was not trying to find him among the crowd. He just happened to be the sort of man who stood out among other gentlemen. And there he was, near an open window, talking to Mr. Beaufort. Both gentlemen were standing stiffly, and neither of them was smiling. It almost looked as if they might be arguing, but I couldn't imagine what they would have to argue about, since they hardly knew one another. It was difficult to not compare the two men as they stood together. Mr. Beaufort was certainly dashing, with his stylish golden hair and the flair of his dress. But seeing him next to Philip, his appeal faded greatly in my mind, for it was obvious, comparing them side by side, that Mr. Beaufort was like a set of paste jewels, flashy on the outside, but really an impostor, with nothing of great value within. Philip, on the other hand, shone like a real gem, without even trying. His clothes were just as well made as Mr. Beaufort's, but he wore them with a natural, athletic grace, and he didn't employ any extreme fashions to create an impression. He was purely elegant, naturally, without thought or planning, and upon looking at them, I found that I would infinitely prefer the real gem to the impostor. I felt sick with disappointment and disgusted with myself. There was no comparison to make. Philip did not want me. Mr. Beaufort did. That was the only thing that mattered. And besides that, I did not want Philip, that handsome, incorrigible, charming tease who stole hearts he had no intention of keeping. I was not aware of Mrs. Fairhurst's presence until she spoke, and then I was startled to hear her so close. "Sir Philip is certainly a great catch, is he not?" She was looking in the same direction I had been, and I blushed, embarrassed, to have been caught watching Philip, especially by her. I turned my back to the man in question and said, "Is he?" She laughed through her nose. "Oh, come, Miss Deventry, you cannot deceive me. I know you are perfectly aware of his attractions." I looked at her with barely concealed loathing. She smiled at me with her lips, but not her eyes. "If I am," I said, "how is that any concern of yours?" "Oh, it's not my concern. I am simply doing you a favour, my dear, since you obviously did not heed my Grace's warning to you when you arrived." She opened her fan and waved it briskly. "He has half the ladies in London violently in love with him every year. Elegant, accomplished ladies of rank and fortune." She lifted an eyebrow as her gaze swept over my figure. "Clearly, you cannot comprehend how far you fall beneath his level." Anger burned away my embarrassment. I knew she was right, but I would not give this atrocious woman the satisfaction of appearing cowed. "Half the ladies in London are in love with Sir Philip, you say?" I asked with an innocent look. She nodded, her smile now quite smug. He would be very disappointed to hear that, for he assured me it was closer to 3/4. Her smile froze. "I wonder which one of us is right," I said. "Shall I ask him?" She snapped her fan closed, her eyes blazing with anger. "That will not be necessary." Suddenly, Philip was standing before us, and both Mrs. Fairhurst and I jumped a little. He ignored Mrs. Fairhurst entirely. Holding out his hand to me, he said, "I believe I have the next dance." Chapter 20. Philip most certainly did not have the next dance, but I was not about to admit that in front of Mrs. Fairhurst. I had no choice but to put my hand in his and let him lead me to the dance floor. This was most unexpected. As he led me to the line of couples, I frantically searched my memory for the list of his faults I had compiled earlier, but I couldn't think clearly while standing across from him, waiting for the music to begin. I was nervous, very nervous. I had never danced with Philip before, and having him watch me with those familiar eyes was making my heart race. I took a deep breath and decided I would pretend he was any one of the ordinary men I had danced with that evening. In fact, I wouldn't even look at his face. I would look at his cravat and say nothing. The music started. I stepped toward Philip as he stepped toward me. I kept my eyes fixed on that perfectly tied cravat. I could do this. I could pretend he was a stranger and never meet his eyes and never feel anything at all while dancing with him. But I had not taken into account one important fact. Philip did not dance like any ordinary man I knew. When he touched my waist, he did not rest his hand passively and lightly. Rather, he pulled me toward him, his hand pressing on the small of my back, so that in a step I was so close I could feel him breathe. A shock raced through me, and I looked up in surprise. I looked into his eyes, which I had sworn I would not do. Oh, my! Perhaps an experienced lady in London would know what to do with the smoldering look he gave me. But I did not, and I found quite to my dismay that when I looked into Philip's eyes, I could not remember a single fault on that list. He said nothing, and I said nothing as we turned. When he released me, my legs felt weak and my hands shook. I turned in a daze to follow the other steps in the dance. Before I was prepared for it, it was time to meet in the middle again. I could not believe I had ever danced this way before without realizing how intimate it was. My hand clasping Philip's, his other hand on my waist, pulling me close while we gazed into each other's eyes. It was all too much. And still, he said nothing to me. I began to think it would be better if he did say something. If only so I could say something flippant in return and dispel the emotion that was building between us. I saw, when he released me, that Lady Caroline stood just behind the line of dancers, watching us, and that Rachel, who was dancing with William several couples down, was also looking our way. My face burned, and I wondered what they were thinking. Did I look like I was trying to ensnare Philip? And where was Cecily? What was she thinking? Just when I thought things couldn't be worse, Philip spoke. He pulled me close and said in a low voice, "Half the ladies in London?" So he had overheard. Yes, that seems to be the general consensus. His eyes narrowed, and he watched me as we moved apart and down the line of dancers. When we met again, he asked, "Is that what you're holding against me?" "I'm not holding anything against you." I spoke stiffly, then tried to smile so he would believe the lie. Philip shook his head. "You're a terrible liar. You shouldn't even try." I glared at him, racking my brain for the perfect reply. Nothing came to mind, however, which may have been because I could never think clearly when I was this close to him.
You know, your glare is not quite the punishment you think it is, he said. His breath brushed my neck and made another shiver run through me. I lifted an eyebrow.
And why is that?
I tried to keep my voice frosty. The steps of the dance took us apart, and I had to wait, tense with anticipation, to hear his answer. Philip never looked away from me. When we finally met in the middle again, he said,
You are even more beautiful when you are angry.
I shot him a dark look.
Don't be absurd.
I'm not, Philip said. His eyes were still smoldering, and I sensed again that restrained passion within him that I had witnessed in the fencing room.
You should see yourself with that flash of fire in your eyes. And when you press your lips together like that, a dimple appears in your left cheek, right next to your mouth. I find it maddening.
I burned with embarrassment and anger and severe discomfort. Philip was flirting with me, and it was very wrong of him. I had always known that his flirting was a game to him, and so that wasn't what made me angry. What angered me was that his flirting made me realize that all of those other gentlemen I had danced with did not know how to flirt at all. Not one of them had made me feel as if I were turned inside out and set on fire all at once. And how could I ever be happy with another man when Philip was around to outshine them all? Besides that, it was apparent that Sir Philip Wyndham was the most infuriating man alive, for now I couldn't even give him an angry look without knowing he enjoyed the sight. I was left, in fact, completely defenseless. There, in the middle of the dance floor, my armor was undone, and the unthinkable happened. I remembered that Philip didn't want me, and never had. My sadness flared to life, burning through my anger, melting every defense I had. Then I made a terrible mistake. At the height of my vulnerability, I looked into Philip's eyes. Time seemed to slow. The music faded away, and the other dancers disappeared. There was nobody in the world except for Philip and me, and I was finally close enough to discover the secret I had sensed in his eyes. It was there, shining so clearly, so obviously, that I wondered how I had never seen it before. I was so stunned, I stopped dancing, appalled, while the truth I had discovered burned devastatingly bright within me. The most surprising part of my discovery was that it wasn't Philip's secret I had seen in his eyes, but my own. I was in love with Philip Wyndham. A second thought immediately followed the first. Philip was certainly not in love with me. Dread dropped through me. Oh, what had I done? How had I been so great a fool?
Marianne?
I blinked and tried to focus on Philip's face. His eyes were tight with concern.
You're very pale, he said. Are you unwell?
He gripped my elbow tightly, as if to hold me up. I nodded.
I was unwell.
Excuse me, I said, turning away from him. I was surprised that he let me go so easily. Perhaps I wrenched myself free, though. I was too dazed to know how it happened, but suddenly I was free of him, and pushing my way through the crowd of dancers. They were turning and smiling and talking and laughing, arms and hands and faces and legs and noise and ribbons and lips. I was jostled, and I pushed back harder, desperate to escape the tumult, when a hand snatched at mine. It was Philip's, and looking over my shoulder, I saw his lips move. He said something, but I couldn't hear what. Everything was too loud and too whirling and too hot. I tripped over dancing feet, and then an arm was around my waist, and Philip pulled me out of the dance, where his mother waited with a worried expression. I sat in a chair by a window. Philip leaned over me, looking very worried, and Lady Caroline was there too, fanning me and asking what had happened.
She nearly fainted in the middle of the dance, Philip said.
What an absurd thing to say. I never fainted. Well, almost never. But I did feel strangely detached from my body. I couldn't feel my legs or arms. I was floating,
groundless. I looked down and was surprised to see Philip's hand gripping mine. I couldn't feel that either. Cecily was suddenly by my side, smelling like lilacs and exuding such soft beauty she looked like an angel.
"Oh, dear," she said. "I thought you looked terribly pale. Where are my smelling salts?"
She took my free hand and rubbed it between hers.
"Are you feeling faint now? Perhaps we should find a place for you to lie down or a drink."
A sense of clarity came back to me as I looked into her familiar blue eyes. They were my mother's eyes, and this was Cecily, my twin sister, who was in love with the same man I was, and who would undoubtedly be able to win his heart. And why shouldn't she? After all, he didn't want me.
"I'm fine," I said, pulling my hand away from Philip's, but not Cecily's. I did not look at him. "I think it was the heat. Please don't give me another thought. I'll sit here by the window for a few minutes and be good as new."
"I'll stay with you," Philip said,
but his solicitude only fired an anger deep within me. How dare he continue to try to deceive me? How dare he continue to toy with my heart?
"No," I said harshly, and saw out of the corner of my eye how Philip's head jerked back with surprise. "You should finish the dance," I continued, trying to soften my voice, "with Cecily."
I was sure Philip was looking at me, but I did not return his gaze. It was part of the defenses I had raised. After a moment, I saw him bow his head and offer Cecily his hand. As soon as they walked away, I turned to Lady Caroline.
"May I go home, please?"
I couldn't even think of an excuse to give her. Concern touched her eyes, but she said nothing more than,
"Of course. I am growing tired of dancing myself. I will accompany you."
I waited at the door while she had the carriage brought around. I kept my back to the dancers so I would not have to watch Philip and Cecily dancing together. Lady Caroline was very considerate and only spoke a few times in the carriage about the ball and the weather. She didn't ask me to confide in her, and I was grateful for that. I think if I had been given a chance, I would have burst into tears. As it turned out, I was able to keep my emotions in check until we reached the house. Betsy was surprised to see me back so early, but I said nothing to explain myself, and after a few minutes she stopped asking questions. As soon as I was out of my gown and into my nightgown, I dismissed her and crawled into bed. I lay awake, examining the workings of my heart. It was a painful and embarrassing exercise, but I needed illumination more than I needed shielding. This is what I discovered. I had loved Philip all along. I had kept it a secret, even from myself, and I had shied away from that secret over and over again. I supposed I had sensed intuitively that once I acknowledged the secret, I would also have to acknowledge the fact that Philip would never feel the same way about me, and that would ruin everything. And my intuition was right. Philip didn't feel the same. In fact, he would do anything to be rid of me. Well, I would make sure he got what he wanted. He would be rid of me as soon as possible. This paradise was ruined for me. As soon as Lady Caroline's ball was over, I would find a way out of Edenbrook, even if it meant going back to Bath. At that decision, I broke all of my promises to myself. With a great wrenching sob, my heart broke open. And I cried, as I had not cried since my mother died.
Chapter 21 Philip was gone when I awoke. Betsy announced it to me in her breathless voice, elated about having new gossip to share. I sat in bed holding the cup of chocolate she brought me, feeling conflicted. The defensive part of me did not want to hear Philip's name at all. The weak part of me wanted to hear of nothing else. I also had a throbbing headache from crying so much through the night. I said nothing as I listened to Betsy's ramblings, as I was involved in a battle between my mind and my heart. "I saw them before they left, Sir Philip and Mr. Wyndham, that is," I was coming from the kitchen, and they were standing in the foyer, and Sir Philip happened to see me. Imagine my surprise when he came and spoke to me. I nearly dropped my cup.
He spoke to you?
Yes. He said, "You're Miss Daventry's maid, are you not?" And I said that I was, and he asked me how you were feeling. "Well enough, I dare say," I told him. And then I remembered that I still had the letter you had asked me to mail in my pocket. So I gave it to him and asked him to frank it. He said he would take care of it, and he took it with him. Now he and Mr. Wyndham are gone, but they will be back in a week, I've heard, for the ball. I stared at her.
You gave my letter to Sir Philip?
Yes. Wasn't it a good idea? I did not want Philip to have my letter. It was personal. What if he somehow accidentally opened it and read it? I knew that was a far-fetched idea, but it was within the realm of possibility. I felt vulnerable knowing he had my letter, and I did not like the feeling one bit. But there was nothing I could do about it. After dressing, I found Cecily lying in her bed, recovering from her late night. My good intentions were firmly in place when I asked her how she had enjoyed the remainder of the ball.
"It was not as enjoyable as I had hoped," she said, covering her yawn with a dainty hand. "Sir Philip was in a strange mood. He hardly spoke two words to me when we danced together, and as soon as the music ended, he walked away. I didn't see him again until the carriage ride home, but luckily Mr. Kellett was very attentive." She flashed me a sly smile. "Very attentive." I was taken aback by her look.
"What do you mean?"
She rolled her eyes. "Marianne, I thought you were a little bit wiser now." She leaned forward and whispered,
"He told me to meet him outside, and when I did, he grabbed me and kissed me."
My smile froze.
"And how was it?"
She leaned back against her pillows, grinning.
"It's like I told you. The rakes are the best kissers."
"Cecily!" I stood abruptly.
How can you act like that and talk like that? How can you even think of another man when you're supposed to be violently in love with Sir Philip?"
"Well, he's not trying to kiss me now, is he? So I might as well find my pleasure where it's available until he does act on his feelings." She raked her hands through her hair. "And there is plenty of pleasure to be had from Mr. Kellett."
I reeled back, shocked. And then I remembered that Philip was off seeking the same type of pleasure. I turned away from her in disgust and walked to the door.
"Where are you going?" she asked, sounding surprised. "Don't you want to hear more about the ball?"
"No," I said, opening the door. My good intentions had fled. "I have no desire to hear anything at all about rakes or kissing, or whatever it is you elegant people do in pursuit of pleasure. You may talk to Louisa about it." I slammed the door shut behind me. Mr. Beaufort called on me later that morning. I had a talk with myself as I walked downstairs to meet him. Here was a handsome, respectable young gentleman who seemed interested in me, and I told myself I should do all that I could to encourage him. After all, a little encouragement from me might lead to an offer of marriage. And right now, when it appeared nobody in the world wanted me, an offer of marriage seemed like a light in the darkness. Lady Caroline sat with Mr. Beaufort in the drawing-room. He still looked dashing and handsome. But now that I had a chance to really look at him, I saw a dullness in his hazel eyes that disconcerted me. But that didn't matter. He wanted to be with me. I focused on flirting and encouraging, and set to it as if it were an arduous task. After half an hour, Mr. Beaufort stood, looking pleased, and bade me good-bye. "I hope I may call on you again soon," he said. I watched him leave before I glanced at Lady Caroline, who had kept us company while we visited. She set aside her embroidery and turned to me with a smile.
"I am going to cut some roses in the garden. Will you join me?"
I wanted to refuse. I was exhausted from my attempts at flirting. But she smiled at me with such warm affection that I couldn't find it in my heart to tell her no. I went upstairs to get my bonnet, and when I returned, she was waiting for me with two baskets and two shears. We walked to the rose garden. I tried not to remember the time I had spent wandering through the gardens with Philip. I tried not to think of Philip at all, actually. Not what we had done, and certainly not what I assumed he was doing right now. That thought made me feel as if I had plunged the shears right into my heart. I started cutting roses and laying them carefully in my basket. After a moment of companionable silence, Lady Caroline said, "There is nothing in my life that makes me happier than to see my children happy, especially Philip." Oh no, she was going to talk to me about Philip? That was the last thing I wanted to hear about. She went on, "It has been so nice, no, more than nice. It has been a real joy to see Philip so happy lately, to see him laughing again." I looked at her in surprise. He didn't laugh before? The idea seemed absurd, incomprehensible even. "Oh no, he used to laugh. He just hasn't recently." She brushed a bee away from the rose she was cutting. "As a boy, Philip was light-hearted and carefree. He had a talent for charming someone out of the sulks, or turning a fight into a comedy. There was always a new energy when he entered a room, as if he carried a ray of sunshine with him wherever he went." She sighed. "But he seemed to lose that part of himself when he took on his father's role. I think the weight of his responsibility made him take himself too seriously. And then, being flattered and pursued by so many ambitious women, well, I fear it ruined him." Her mouth set in a firm line. "He became an arrogant boor." She snipped a rose. I thought of my first impression of Philip at the inn. "I know what you mean. I encountered that arrogance when I first met him." Lady Caroline smiled. "Insufferable." "Yes, he was," I agreed with a laugh. "But he's not like that any more, is he?" I shook my head. I hadn't thought of it before, but Philip's arrogance was a distant memory for me. "That's what I meant when I said it was a joy to see him happy again," Lady Caroline said. "It is as if we have our Philip back, the Philip we all love, the Philip we have all missed these past few years. And having him back has made the whole family happy in a way we haven't been since my dear husband died." She stopped cutting and turned to me. Putting a gentle hand on my arm, she said, with utter sincerity, "We all feel so indebted to you, my dear." I was so surprised that I snipped off a large white rose too close to its head. Feeling like I had just beheaded something, I shoved my shears into my basket. "You think this change in him is because of me?" I asked in disbelief. "Why, I know it is." She continued cutting roses as if our conversation was at an end. I watched her in suspense, wanting her to convince me that she was right, even though I knew she was wrong. My heart had not yet succumbed to my will. I wanted to hope, even though hope was futile and foolish. I tried to bite back the words, but finally, in a moment of weakness, I blurted, "How do you know?" Her lips twitched as if she were fighting back a smile. It reminded me of an expression I had seen on Philip's face more than once. She put her shears in her basket and gestured to a bench set in the shade of a tree. Sitting beside her, I wondered if this was the most foolish thing I had done yet. "Did you know that Philip was running away the night you two met?" I nodded, remembering what Betsy had told me. Lady Caroline sighed. "I'm afraid I am partly to blame for that. Philip had returned from town a few weeks before. He can't stand staying in London for the whole season. I thought it was an accomplishment that I had gotten him there for any part of it. Well, I didn't send him word that you and your sister were going to visit.
I left the girls with my son and his wife and came here myself to warn Philip and prepare for your visit.